You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 8th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Andrew Muller.
Coming up on today's programme, we will survey the works of personages hoping to persuade you to give their life story as a Christmas present. Our book reviewer takes us through a few of the festive season's autobiographies.
Also ahead, we'll take a look at what we could be getting up to this weekend if we happen to be in Toronto.
Even with the holiday season fast approaching, Toronto's busy events calendar shows no signs of easing.
And our guest music reviewer this week is a man who's been promoting interesting new music in London for almost 15 years. He'll join us to talk us through some of his current favourite tracks.
All that, plus we'll talk to the New Yorker's TV critic about what's been catching her eye this year.
Having mean female characters who aren't likeable, adorable, and wonderful and relatable, to me, expands radically the emotional range of what you can do on television as far as women's roles.
And we'll have our weekly global cultural roundup. So lots to look forward to, as ever, this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Yes, welcome to The Review here on Monocle 24.
You have been on your travels this week, haven't you, Andrew Muller, in the name of culture?
I have. I've been on tour the last couple of weeks.
And what have you been touring?
I have been touring with the North Sea Scrolls, a farrago of spoken word and esoteric balladry composed by myself and the two greatest Anglo-Irish songwriters of their generation, Luke Haines and Cathal Coughlan.
You've been doing gigs in a pith helmet, haven't you?
We have also. We do all wear pith helmets. It has been a
and
triumph.
And you don't perform in a musical sense either. I have spies who have seen you this week.
I do on the last song.
I
contribute guitar to the climactic anthem.
Please forgive me for not coming to see you this week, because I am very used to sitting next to you and listening to you talk a great deal, and so as a result I thought...
Yeah, but not in a pith helmet.
Well, and the listener doesn't need to know that.
But the pith helmet, and I am wearing one right now, obviously, the listener should be aware of. But yeah, the North Sea Scrolls album available in all good stores.
Highlights and lowlights of this week?
Highlights, definitely the second show we did at St Pancras Old Church, which was Thursday night, which was fantastic. Lowlights, I have to say, this show at Brighton Comedia, which was just a baffling evening all round. That's the only show I think we've left even more confused than the audience.
My spy went to the London one
on Thursday evening,
but went to the wrong church and walked into a carol service with Barbara Windsor, Christopher Biggins and Lionel Blair, and thought, Andrew Muller's got quite a good audience this evening, hasn't he?
Interestingly, Sid James does figure as a minor character in the narrative of the North Sea Scrolls.
Maybe that's something to work on next.
It's all coming together.
And for those of us who aren't aware of who Barbara Windsor, Christopher Biggins and Lionel Blair are, I think you should just look up any television from about the 1970s onwards in the United Kingdom.
Or just be grateful that you don't know who these people are.
It was quite a surreal experience for him, I must confess. Lots to pack into today, including a great book review coming up here on The Review.
The famously tongue-tied Hollywood impresario Samuel Goldwyn once asserted that I don't think anybody should write his autobiography until after he's dead. Despite this excellent advice, autobiographies have become a staple of seasonal reading. Publishers all too aware that the memoirs of the famous are safe-ish bets as gifts for relatives you don't know all that well.
This year we're given offerings from Sebastian Coe, the former Olympic long-distance runner, former UK Member of Parliament, and as chairman of the London 2012 Organising Committee, was the man who is credited with bringing the games to the British capital with success. So we can expect a tale of determination, commitment and hard work. What we can expect from Rod Stewart's autobiography is far less certain. By all accounts, it contains tales of hiding behind a plant to avoid the amorous advances of Janis Joplin. One man who can tell us more is today's book reviewer, writer and journalist Mark Mason. Welcome to the studio, Mark. Which one do we want to begin with? Do we want to start with Seb or Rod?
Let's get the bad stuff out of the way, shall we? You know, when you're a kid and you eat the vegetables on your plate that you really hate and you leave the good stuff till last. Let's do Seb first.
What was your... You're not a fan then?
Well, I didn't really know what I thought of him before I read the book. And you know when you have that experience of it just really confirming what you sort of suspected? That book has been like that the whole way through. I'll just read you a little bit of the first paragraph of the whole book. which is the first chapter, by the way, is entitled Beginnings, which gives you a sort of sense of just how pretentious this could
be. I would argue that's a reasonably good place to start.
It's logical, but the fact that he puts it in
the
plural.
It sounds like music-based a song on it.
In the plural. Beginning would right. be all right, but beginnings.
It would have been more pompous if he'd started in the beginning.
He might as well have done.
I see, I have no problem with that, because that's a safe pointer. And I think with autobiographies, you do need safe pointers.
You do, and also I found myself saying to a friend about this, because the only reason I was reading this, I was reviewing them very close together. And after I'd read Seb's, I still talk of him as a friend. I suspect after this he probably won't be my friend. I was talking to a friend of mine in the pub and he said, what's it like? And I said, it's just 350 pages of him banging on about himself. He talks about himself all the time. And my friend said, it is his autobiography. And I thought, well, there is that, but there are ways of talking about yourself that reveal things about yourself. As a clue, here's that first paragraph. One of my most treasured possessions is a portrait my father painted of me when I was 8.
No.
So, you know, already the egomania is in there. It's a portrait of himself.
Already my eyelids are drooping.
We're now William Pitt the Younger, aren't we?
We are. Oh, he wishes. And I'm going to cut out most of it. He describes the painting. He says, "And my father taught himself to paint and to sculpt and did it, like everything he turned his hand to, with aplomb. And, of course, a few years later, he applied himself to a much less likely challenge than painting a portrait of his son, namely turning that same son into the fastest middle-distance runner of his generation."
Right.
Now, you're saying that thing about yourself.
That's an ugly sentence at so many levels.
It's an ugly paragraph to begin with. And that he just is obsessed with himself, Seb Coe. Now, OK, it's his autobiography.
I had the mickey taken out of me slightly before we came on air, because I went through it this morning and I think I just shouted, "It's just a list about what he's done," to which my esteemed colleagues turned around and went, "That's what happens in autobiographies." But I couldn't quite. I think I said that in quite a sort of clumsy way. What I think I intended to say was it didn't have any sense of context, any sense of involvement from anybody else. It didn't have events that were. It wasn't actually very interesting.
That's the thing.
It was like a. You know when you fill in a job application and you say, you know, I went to school and I did this and then I did that and then I did the other. But then I ask myself, is this because Sebastian Coe has for his entire life had to be entirely self-motivated as a runner? He is on his own the whole way.
That's the thing, though, he isn't. I can understand why you'd say that. Having read the book more thoroughly, the thing is he does praise other people, but only ever from bringing out the best in him. I mean, his father's mentioned because his father was his trainer for most of his career. He praises a school teacher, but only because that school teacher gave him very neat handwriting. It's the school teacher who taught him how to write. So Seb Coe is a man who is even in love with his own handwriting.
But this book is a job application, basically, as you were suggesting there, Emma. I mean, the job for which he is applying is Mayor of London.
Well, he's... he just lists his qualities the whole time. The book is full of sentences that begin things like, "I am known for many things." The thing is...
It is a genuinely fabulously, almost mesmerisingly tedious book. But what we were saying there about autobiographies being a bunch of stuff the person did, they are. But they should be about more than that. They should be a portrait of their times, a portrait of the events through which the person lived.
Circumstance is key.
As I was saying earlier, on the train in on the way this morning, I am rereading, because I often do, because it's a great book, the volume of H.L. Mencken's memoirs in which he talks about being a newspaperman in Baltimore in the early 20th century. And it's glorious because it's a terrific portrait of journalism 100 years ago, of Baltimore 100 years ago, of the people he worked with and the things he saw and the things he did. And it's a terrific book. But H.L. Mencken, of course, had the considerable advantage of being one of the greatest English prose stylists of all time, which I think it's fair to say even Sebastian Coe admit is not a quality he possesses.
It's not a badly written book. I mean, that's not my complaint about it. It's not. His prose style is okay. He can turn out a nice sentence. The problem is, the crucial difference... Let's talk about Rod a bit to set up the contrast.
Please, let's talk about Rod.
We're going to play random pages. It's going to be good fun.
If you want any clue as to how great Rod's book is, it contains the sentence, "We were joined on stage by a perhaps over-refreshed John Bonham." And any book that's got that sentence in it is... I know what you mean about the painting a portrait of your times. I think it's fair to say Seb Coe does that. He talks a lot about running in the 80s. He talks about the amateur sport. But...
Not
the crucial difference
context.
Is he doesn't do it with humour. He doesn't do it.
No, he does.
He cannot laugh at himself. He's one of those people.
He does come across as epically, epically pompous.
And if you take yourself too seriously, no one else is going to take you seriously. That's the conundrum. And if you love yourself as much as he obviously does, it's very hard for other people to love you.
There is something that struck me in that book which was the absence of anybody else involved in the background. You have his father, but I was astonished that I had to get to page 254 before I read the sentence. It was the first time I had an insight into what life might be like if I shared it with someone else.
Yeah, it's only ever for half a sentence that he'll praise someone else, and it always ends up with, because they helped bring out the best in
Sorry. There is an astonishing two paragraphs in which he dispatches a marriage which has produced four children. And he just goes, my marriage didn't work out. It was very sad. It had just been preceded by an enormously glowing description of William Whitpitt the Younger and William Wilberforce. You knew exactly where his focus is. And I mean, I don't know what the circumstances of Mr. Coe's, you know, the collapse of Mr. Coe's life, private life was, when obviously he got divorced. It was obviously left out of the book for a particular reason. But even his new wife, because I think he remarried in 2011, we have a picture of her, but we don't hear about her. We have no idea what on earth Sebastian Coe's private life is like.
Whereas with Rod's, if you want private life, if you want a portrait of the time, go on, let's just, we were playing this game. Go on, open Rod's book at any random page.
Any random page. Brilliant.
While you do that, I'm going to fill you in just on a bit of his private life. As an example of another great sentence from Rod's book. When he's going out with Britt Eklund in the 70s, she used to write to him, because in those days you had to do that. She used to write to him and send him her knickers in the post. And in brackets he puts, my word, how email has changed things. He's got that real ability to laugh. Now, the thing is, when you say laugh at yourself, you could think I'm saying, well, Seb Coe really knows how great a runner he was and is prepared to say so. Rod is doing that faux modest, oh, I've only sold the 200 million records. No, Rod Stewart takes himself just as seriously in terms of his professionalism. But simultaneously, you can do that thing of sort of laughing at yourself. For instance, he reveals Long John Baldry, the blues singer from the 60s in Britain, who incidentally is where the John in Elton John came from. Elton John renamed himself after Reg Dwight. He became Elton John after Long John Baldry. Baldry was a really important figure. And as Seb Coe praises his teacher, but only to say she gave me nice handwriting, Rod talks about Long John Baldry with such fondness and says, I still carry his picture around in my wallet today. And he's the guy who taught Rod Stewart had to stand at a microphone. He says, you stand with your feet apart. If you stand with your feet together when you're at the mic, he doesn't give you any presence.
I think that maybe represents a difference in the fields in which these two subjects have accomplished things. I think you have to be a little bit self-deprecating and able to laugh at yourself if you've made it in a field like rock music, in which Rod Stewart has made some amazing records and is a great singer, but he has nonetheless succeeded in a field in which charlatans and frauds and chances succeed all the time. Whereas Sebastian Coe succeeded in a field where you can't fake it.
Yeah, but he also succeeded in the field of politics. Absolutely. And for instance, if you hear William Hague talk about his own career, William Hague has got that warmth.
But I do think having myself interviewed at various points, lots of musicians and also a few athletes, that thing that you were saying earlier, Emma, you need that incredible focus, single-minded determination to be that good in athletics, whereas politics, the arts, you can kind of get away with stuff.
You can, but if you think about what he wants to be next, and we're all speculating on him being the next mayor of London, look who's doing that job at the moment. This is someone who looks as if he's accidentally walked into the office.
Yeah,
I mean,
I
admittedly, he is actually almost tailoring that as his driving force. But one doesn't get any impression as to what Sebastian Coe is really like, apart from almost like an automaton.
The converse of that being, I think, Boris Johnson's best time for the 1500 metres would be about 400 metres.
The very good news about that type of cocaine we happily discovered, quite apart from the almost immediate euphoria it induced, was that when you were on it, you could still get an erection. That is not from Sebastian Coe's
autobiography. No, we should be very clear. That's Rod Stewart speaking there.
And read the bit at the end about where a member of Rod Stewart's band, when they go off stage between the supposed end of the gig and the first encore, there's a roadie backstage who's famous for getting naked. And when the guitarist goes off and gets his replacement guitar from the roadie's standing there naked to give him his guitar.
Brilliant.
And there's a bit about...
Sorry, and this is my contribution to the random sentence on random page game. Top of page 107. Incredibly, I've only been carjacked once.
And that involves drugs as well, because the guy who... he's only had one road accident in Los Angeles. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. He smashes into a truck, gets out. The guy from the truck driver gets out. And they quickly realise that they're both as high on drugs as each other and say to each other, we better get away from here pretty quickly. And they just drive off.
Is it about, it leads me to my question, is it about a life of pure hedonism? Because I heard an interview with him and he said he did engage in drugs, but it never became a massive problem for him. He knew when to step back. And I think that's probably what's contributed to his longevity. Regardless of the quality of his music, he is still sharp as a tack.
Absolutely. And he always has been. And you get the sense, this goes back to what we've been saying about the praising other people. You get the sense that came from his family. He talks about his family a hell of a lot, his brothers and his parents. And the brilliant bit, I mean, this sounds like a nice little funny anecdote, but I think it's deeper than that. In the 70s, when he started to make a lot of money. I mean, to the point where in the early 70s, his accountant tells him, Rod, you've got to spend 100 grand on a house because otherwise the tax man's going to have the lot. And Rod Stewart can't find a house worth 100 grand. The most he can find, this is the 70s before property went mad, the most he can spend is 89 grand. So this is the point when he says to his mother, Mom, I've made a lot of money. Please let me buy you a really stupidly big Christmas present to spoil you. She thinks about it and she eventually says to him, yeah, I want a new bread bin.
Bless her.
And he comes from a family like that, and he's grounded. His feet with Long John Broadie having told him they should be far apart at the microphone. They're like that. They're on the ground. There's a sense that he knows what's going on in the world. It's a very pub book. He comes from that culture from North London where you spent time in the pub, you did gigs in the pub, and then but you always come back to the pub. Whereas with Sebco, as you said, there's no sense of context. You don't know. I'm sure he does go to pubs, Sebco.
I don't think he does. And if he does, he'll have a glass of still water. He's the kind of man who's thinking about his next achievement.
There'll be gastropubs.
Rod Stewart,
yeah.
You get the impression that he's almost collapsing into his next adventure.
And there's also, it's given me a real insight into why urban myths become successful, because Sebco has publicly denied the urban myth I'm about to tell you. And he says he doesn't mind it. He can understand why people tell it. There's a story of him at Lord's turning up for a cricket match that he's going to watch, and he's at the wrong gate. Now, Lord's is a pretty big cricket ground, and he's meeting someone just inside the gate he's at. And the guy says, no, I'm sorry, with your ticket, sir, you've got to go all the way around the ground, go into that gate and come back across here to meet him. Sebco says, I haven't got time to do that. And they argue and argue. And eventually Sebco says the one thing you should never say in this situation.
Don't
you know who I am? The guy on the gate, the guys on the gate at Lord's are famous for not letting anyone in, to the point that they once refused to let Clive Lloyd in, despite the fact he was captaining the West Indies in the match that day. He says, I'm afraid I don't know. He says, well, I'm Sebco. And the guy says, well, in that case, you can run around there all the quicker, can't you? Now, that's a nice little urban myth. But you can see why these things become true, because there are enough people, obviously, who've dealt with Sebco or have got to know of him who think that could be true about Sebco. It sort of has the ring of truth about it, even though it isn't true.
It's one of those things, though, that its inclusion would not detract from Sebco too much. It would sort of add a little bit of humanity to the fact that I remember once watching an interview with Linford Christie, and the best question was, have you ever missed a bus? And it's lovely to put your career and your entire lifestyle into context, which is sadly absent. I can see Andrew Muller has found another good sentence from the random
go on. Open a page, random sentence game. Rod Stewart, the autobiography. This is beautiful phrase making. Behind us lay a British Airways first class cabin, liberally redecorated with mustard.
Oh. The things they do in hotel rooms, you just wouldn't believe. But he's also got a nice turn of phrase. I don't know how much ghostwriting went on in that book.
I was going to say, how much has been written by each of the gentlemen that we are quite unusually comparing quite directly? I've never thought I'd be putting Sebco and Rod Stewart side by side in a review.
It'd be a question for the A-level paper, wouldn't it?
It would.
Compare and contrast.
Sebco, I'd say, completely wrote himself. From what I know of him, I know his stuff about his journalism. I think he would have written that 100%. And he would have refused to have a ghostwriter, probably knowing him. You get the impression. Rod, I dare say a bit of ghostwriting. There's no one mentioned in the acknowledgements as just an editor. But it contains sentences like the 1970s were a brown and dingy few years. It's nicely written. It's
lovely.
But also laughing at himself. Stuff when he splits up with one of his girlfriends, he's so distraught that to try and get over it, he takes up yoga. He said, that didn't last very long. I tried once and ended up falling into the fireplace. And it's just this image of Rod Stewart, probably in those leopard skin.
Yeah. He's got the spiky hair. Off we go.
And also he's very good on round avoidance techniques. He's sort of known for being quite stingy. And he says, it's perfectly true, I am stingy. Good trick for not buying the first round in the pub. Get to the pub door on the way in. Get there first and open the door for everyone else and hold it open so they go in before you do.
Writer and journalist Mark Mason, author of The Importance of Being Trivial, among other titles. Thank you very much for that survey of the lives and works of Sebastian Coe and Rod Stewart. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. Up next, we pack our bags and see what's ahead in this week's week. This week, I'm going to try that whole thing again. We see what's ahead this weekend in this weekend's Look Ahead. There, that wasn't hard, was it?
The latest culinary trends, restaurants with the best food, the coziest cafes, and the makers behind them. The menu tells you all you need to know about the world of cuisine and drinks, and the people who are doing things differently.
The end is very important, just as in a sad ending, you may feel sort of sad in a play. No, there's no such thing as a sad ending for a meal, but there is the idea of a resounding ending, like the coda of a last movement of a symphony.
From organic cuisine in Sao Paulo to the latest coffee trends in Helsinki, from the most adventurous speakeasy in New York to the best butchers in Sydney, tune in on Fridays at 1900 hours London time or download the shows from Monocle's website.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
It's Saturday here in London, so you must be listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Time now to fill you in on the best the world has to offer in terms of weekend fun. Here's Nelly Gocheva.
This weekend, Soho Theatre in London welcomes Mighty Day, a new play by BAFTA-winning playwright Jack Thorne. The play follows one night in the life of a couple struggling with blame and guilt on the first anniversary of a shared personal tragedy. Set entirely in a bathroom and directed by Vicky Jones, the play is on until the 22nd of December. For more details, visit sohotheatre.com. If in Paris, stop by Centre Pompidou to check out the latest Dali retrospective, displaying 200 of the surrealist's greatest works. Brought together in association with Madrid's Reina Sofia Museum, the show also features a selection of films, photography and sketches from Dali's career. The retrospective is on until the 25th of March. The 9th edition of Dubai International Film Festival kicks off this Sunday, screening 160 films from 61 countries in 43 languages. Don't miss Him Hereafter by Sri Lanka's director Asoka Handagama, Factory of Lies by Saudi Arabian Hamza Jamjoum, and French-Belgium co-production Rust and Bone, directed by Jacques Audiard. For more details on the program, go to dubaifilmfest.com. In Ankara, Gallery Nef hosts a solo exhibition by Turkish painter Elvan Alpay. Biophilia features the latest works by Alpay, who is renowned for her three-dimensional paintings, bright colors, and geometric figures. Biophilia is at Gallery Nef until the 5th of January. And on our playlist this weekend is international artist Sin Kane, who is playing some dates in London and Brooklyn next week. Sin Kane has been a life member and studio hand for acts including Caribou and Yes Air. Expect dance floor pop with a funk-infused electronic bounce. For all tour dates, visit sinkane.com. Let's hear Running. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
And that was Running by Sin Kane, ending that report there from Nelly Gocheva, or Gocheva. This is The Review on Monocle 24.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're staying in the UK, joined by Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, a company that promotes British music around the world. Welcome, Crispin.
Good morning.
First of all, I guess, tell us a bit about British Underground. I guess, yeah, where it started and how it started and what you're working on now.
Well, we are essentially a music events production company. Our remit is to promote British music abroad, primarily new and emerging music. So we do that through showcasing, which is a very particular and quite a modern form of music promotion at events like South by Southwest, which many people have heard of, which is a huge convention down in Austin, Texas. There's another one we've recently done in WOMEX, which was in Thessaloniki in Greece, which is a world music convention. We are working in on a project in Brazil right now, where we're bringing sort of setting up a cultural exchange between Salvador and London. So it's music promotion, but with a slight difference, and it's primarily public funded as well.
You say that you do showcasing because it's new and different. You've been doing British Underground for what, nigh on 15 years now. How has the job of promoting changed in that time?
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting. If you are a new artist and you want to break into a new country, there are now anchor points where you can go. So there didn't used to be. I was British Underground, along with a company called the BPI, did the first sort of British showcases at South by Southwest, and that was in 2002. And we had Elbow were on the lineup, a band called Oxide and Neutrino, and a couple of other bands that didn't quite make it as far as those two. But it was new. We did it in a very small venue in this rather big conventioneering town, and it took off. We had big names big journalists from Rolling Stone came down, the New York Times came down. They were interested in what the British offering was. So that was a very small project. If you go there in 2013, you'll find a building called the British Music Embassy with 140 UK acts playing. Every major media brand will be involved with it. There will be brands who want to sell their products there. It's a huge thing now. So that's taken 10 years to build that.
And do the bands have to be established in the United Kingdom before you take them away?
Absolutely not. No, I think on that original bill with Elbow, we selected a band that I thought would do very well in America called Oceanside. So they were unheard of. We just toured them around some venues in the Northwest, in fact. So we were... You can get selected if we think you're the right thing to go over there. And we've just done the funding round for bands. So if you're a band and you want to go to South by Southwest, you can get funding from us. You do that through a scheme called British Music Abroad. That'll pay for your flights and accommodation. This is all quite new stuff, by the way. And we've just done the funding round for that. And those bands certainly are not established, but they're ones that we and our sort of peer group, the people who work with us, think are right for that event.
How daunting is America for British bands now? Because obviously you've seen this up close, and I've seen this in my previous life as a rock journalist as well, that even a big British band who's got to a point where they're well known in Britain, they're selling records in Britain, and all of a sudden they're planted in this enormous, fathomless country that couldn't care less about them. And it does require a considerable amount of nerve, I think, and commitment for a British band to commit to especially the touring. And the handshaking that is necessary in America.
You need to know about the glad handing. You have to go and do this sort of thing in every little tin pot town in the States, East Coast and West Coast. I think we are in a very interesting place, actually, with bands like Mumford & Sons. That's the biggest rock band in the world right now. We've got Adele, who's got the most enormous selling album. This has all come from big traction in the States. And there are many other artists coming underneath that. And in fact, if I were in a band right now, I'd look at Mumford & Sons and say, well, I should be doing folk rock because that's what's going to take off in the States and the UK right now.
How do you decide what you think is going to work in the United States? Because if you look at Mumford & Sons, you'd think on the surface, that wouldn't be the automatic entry into the United States. How do you choose what you're going to send out there?
It's a good question. But if you look at the history of British music in the States, they're very interested in things that perhaps are not what UK hipsters are interested in. So I think Mumford & Sons is a little bit like the way that Led Zeppelin broke in the States. They broke in the States first, no real critical support, but they just played and they played and they played well. They were in Britain, they were seen as a sort of rather Tolkien, too heavy for mainstream music kind of thing in the 70s. But we now look at them, they're critically lauded. And Mumford & Sons have gone over, they've got, I mean, they're very ambiguous about their Christian sort of the take on that and their music, which is good in the States. There's a huge Christian music market. They are in America. There's a genre called Americana, which they are fitting into. Even though they're a British band, they're coming under this Americana umbrella, so they're completely pushed through that genre. So and they also respect their roots. They're technically good. These are the things, and they probably do all the glad handing as well. These are the things that you need to have in America. So for Mumford, I'm not surprised, actually. I think that's a really good call. And I think they'll probably get bigger and bigger. I mean, most likely be like Coldplay, have that kind of career.
Well, on the subject of Americana, of the tracks that you've selected to talk us through today, one of them is very much of that ilk. This is Robert Ellis, who's signed to New West, which is a very serious Americana label, home of Steve Earle, Old 97's Cor Blund, and also recent Midori House guests, the Mastersons. Introduce this one for us.
Well, this is about... I was over in Nashville at the Americana convention in September. This, I guess, is the standout artist for me. I'll probably come on to this a little bit later on, but I also produce events here. One of the things I think is going to be readdressed quite soon in the UK is country music, particularly Nashville-style American country music, so this is why I've selected this track.
Okay, this is Robert Ellis with... What's the song called?
This one is called Westbound Train.
You there ring, clear all that westbound train. Already passed me by, and I know just why. You'd want to hitch a ride on. Other trains will be coming through, and I'm gonna catch one too. Yeah, we do what we have to do.
And that was Westbound Train by Robert Ellis, the choice of today's music reviewer, Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, a company that promotes British music around the world. What was it that attracted you to that track?
Well, I went to this convention called the Americana Awards. That's an awards. It starts with an awards ceremony in the Ryman Auditorium and then is a convention. So there are, I guess, keynote speakers, panels, and then in the evenings, four evenings of very intense showcasing by artists from across the world. So at that kind of event, and a lot of American artists, a lot of Nashville artists, but also Australians and New Zealanders. And part of my remit for going there was to see whether we could get any British acts into that bill. I talked to the director there, and I think we're going to try and put some kind of British presence into that event next year, which would be, I guess, September 2013. So while I'm there, I like to see what else is going on. And that I saw that guy play on his own at the Ryman Auditorium, the home of Nashville Country, and I thought it was amazing.
Well, the next track you've picked for us is one by Sam Lee. Tell us about him.
Oh, well, I've worked with Sam Lee for a long time. He's just recently been nominated for the Mercury Prize. He didn't win, but his album is a very interesting album. He's moving folk music out of the folk ghetto and putting it a little bit into the mainstream now. We did a project about in 2010 called Looking for a New England, where we picked the best of the rising folk artists from here, people like the Unthanks and Jim Murray, and we put them on a showcase at South by Southwest. It went down very well, got a lot of media coverage, and Sam hosted that showcase, and we've worked with him since then, actually, and he's about to headline a show for us at a project called Folk Alliance in Toronto in February.
His track's called Goodbye, My Darling. Let's have a listen.
Forever. Oh, England, oh, England, I'll not see you more. For I'm worn out with fever cast down to death's door. And if ever I live to see 7 years more.
Goodbye, My Darling by Sam Lee. That was chosen by Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, a company promoting British music around the world. We were just saying it was possibly the second time that we've ever heard a banjo on Monocle 24. Andrew Muller can recall the first. But is there something about folk music, which obviously has an enormous following, but there's always a slight hurdle in terms of getting it into the mainstream? Mumford & Sons do a little bit, but it's never quite broken through.
Oh, well, I think the interesting thing about, I mean, with all music in this country more and more is you'll have a folk scene, you'll have a pop scene, you'll have a hip-hop scene. And actually, it's always, with folk music, there's always been a series of gatekeepers who try and keep the folk music very real. So I think it is quite hard for folk music, in its purest sense, to step out of that, because actually it's quite difficult music to listen to. There are often 40 verses in a song. It's often never really quite gets into a climax. It's quite slow music. It's not very easy to engage. That's why Sam Lee is so interesting, because he's gone around the country. He's talked to... he's gone and collected these songs and he's put them into a contemporary setting. And the interesting thing is seeing him, he played at Womex this year in Thessaloniki, and actually the crowd, the world music crowd, got what he did for the first time. So I think, again, he is a folk music singer, but he's needed to attach a contemporary setting to make that work, which is what Mumford & Sons really do.
It is weird. English folk in particular always strikes me as being on the verge of strangling itself to death with its own sort of slightly hidebound pious notions of authenticity. And it's what I really liked about the Unthanks, for example, who actually had fun with it and realised that this was still a living thing, not a museum piece.
But I mean, all music has its own sort of prejudices, its own ideas, its own idea of what authenticity is. And I mean, I work in so many different genres. I can see that with everything. We're going to do some look at reggae in a little while. It's exactly the same. These small genres have their own ideas that sort of keep them in one place. But of course, the next generation comes, knocks that out of the way, and then you get a whole new thing going on. That's happening in folk right now, actually. There are new ideas. There are new people coming in. Those that set the tone in the 80s and 90s are now moving on to hand it over to the likes of Sam Lee.
Let's head to Brazil, we think, for our next track. We couldn't find anything about this band coming up. Os Nelsons, far as we know. Who are they and what are we going to hear?
Well, I don't know a great deal about them. I met them in Salvador. I was invited over by the Bahian government to start looking at a cultural exchange between Salvador and London. Salvador is in the northeastern quarter of Brazil. It's a big, very musical city. It's very African, it's very Caribbean, it's got a lot of bass culture there. And Os Nelsons were one of the bands that came. I sat in a room with several other people from the UK music industry doing a sort of information exchange with the local cultural scene there. And Os Nelsons came and presented their music. And he very much reminded me, the guy who presented it, of one of the Strokes. He had such an energy about him and such a sort of idea of what he was and how he was and who he should be that I thought I'd bring this music over here and play it on this show. Why not?
Let's hear from them. And that was Os Nelsons from Brazil and Conversa de Vizinhos, the choice of Crispin Parry.
That was quite mad.
That was bonkers.
It's good, really, really good.
Why did you choose that?
Because we're working on a project that came out of the reggae project we ran called Bass Culture Clash this year. It's now called Bass Culture Clash, that is marrying up artists from London and artists from Salvador, Brazil. We're going to do some work over in Salvador next May, and we're going to bring that project back to the London Roundhouse and hopefully premiere it at the Great Escape in May, which is another convention.
I did want to ask, apart from your focus on the United States, where else are you taking British music? I mean, the fact that you are doing an exchange with Brazil seems culturally correct, given what's just about to happen in Brazil with the whole world looking at it. Where do you like to take your music?
Well, I mean, the one that I'm looking at and thinking about for 2014 is taking heavy metal to India. There's a demand there. There's no way in. So that's what we're looking at, some festivals and places to take heavy metal with a magazine called Metal Hammer.
We wish you the very best of luck with that.
I actually quite fancy coming along to
We're
watch
all coming
that happen.
For that one.
Indian heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that.
Sounds amazing. Crispin Parry, founder of British Underground, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Pleasure.
Time now to focus on the world city's cultural offerings over the next few days.
And this week we head to Toronto, where your guide is Monocle correspondent Chris Frey. Take it away, Chris.
Even with the holiday season fast approaching, Toronto's busy events calendar shows no signs of easing. And among the highlights of this upcoming week are two of the city's cultural heroes. First, instrumental post-rock ensemble Do Make Say Think play one of its rare shows tonight at the Opera House. Over the past 15 years, the highly regarded band has forged an imagistic hybrid sound of jazz, punk, electronic, and psychedelia that artfully balances dissonance and melody. Then it's the latest film from Peter Mettler, the Swiss-Canadian avant-garde documentarian, opening Wednesday, December 12th at the TIFF Bell Lightbox. The End of Time is another of Mettler's typically gorgeous, contemplative, and ontological documentaries. After exploring the nature of transcendence in Gambling Gods and LSD, Mettler is again chasing big subject matter, this one investigating the nature of time. If gift shopping is the priority this weekend, December 8th and 9th, drop by the always charming City of Craft, a craft show and exhibition that brings together an eclectic range of independent local designers and craftspeople. From ceramics, art prints, and clothes, to handmade specialty books, jewelry, and textiles, there'll be no shortage of ideas to fill out your holiday shopping list. City of Craft takes over the Theater Center on Queen Street West.
A divorce is actually comparatively rare among standard New York social types, contrary to what people might think.
Well, usually there's something wrong, though. Dead fathers are a common problem. Jane's father's dead, very suddenly, last year.
Must have been awful for her.
Yes. It was tough on him, too.
Over the course of the 1990s, the filmmaker Whit Stillman carved a niche for himself with a trio of chatty, smartly crafted comedies of manners set among well-bred and self-obsessed young New Yorkers. Next week, the director arrives in Toronto to present screenings of his films Metropolitan and Last Days of Disco and reflect back on his work. That happens at the Royal Theatre on December 12th and 13th.
Riff-raff. He's hardly that.
Oh, you mean because of his title? We're supposed to be impressed by that. On the contrary, I think the titled aristocracy are the scum of the earth.
Last, you'll want to stop by the Museum of Contemporary Canadian Art to catch its exhibition featuring a collection of works by previous winners of the prestigious Sobey Art Award, a prize granted annually to the best Canadian artist under 40. It runs until the end of the month. For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Christopher Frey.
And you're with a review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in just a moment to find out what television we should be watching on the East Coast with a TV critic for The New Yorker. Stay tuned.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and wants to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on Monocle.com.
Welcome back. It's Saturday afternoon. You're listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller, and Emma Nelson.
To end today's show, we travel across the Atlantic to hear about what television is making an impact on the East Coast. Monocle's Katie Bilboa talked earlier to Emily Nussbaum, TV critic for The New Yorker, a lady who's watched more television than the whole review team have had hot dinners, and we've had a few.
I chose 30 Rock, Homeland, Enlightened, American Horror Story, and Scandal, which are shows that in certain ways have very little to do with one another. But I think that they're all doing interesting, challenging things to television. And part of what I'm intrigued by in shows is partially, obviously, whether they're entertaining, satisfying, well-made, but also what they do for TV as a whole. And all of these shows, I feel, are doing challenging things as far as the genres they're working in, as far as their relationship in the audience. 30 Rock is actually ending this year, but it's a terrific sitcom and super sharp, basically a machine producing well-crafted zingers. And like a lot of interesting and, to a certain extent, radical sitcoms or comedies on TV, it's kind of an allergic response to television itself in the same way that, for instance, Monty Python was a response to the boringness of aspects of the BBC, or SCTV responded to a sort of lame cable shows. 30 Rock's a response to NBC falling apart. And I just think it's an incredibly smart show about television. It's a smart show about Liz Lemon, the main character, who's this sort of mirror of Tina Fey. And one of the things I really admire about the show is not only is it just filled with well-crafted jokes, but there's a level at which the show is unsentimental without actually being a cynical or cruel comedy. I'm really going to miss it. I feel like it's going out on top also, which is exciting for me. You know, a lot of times by the time a sitcom goes away, it's in very bad shape.
I know you're on the final series over there in the US, but we've got a short clip just so our listeners can get a feel for what the show's like. We think it's from season 2 or 3, so let's just have a quick listen.
I Google myself all the time, like when Angie's not in the mood or I'm alone in a hotel.
Tracy, you do know that Googling yourself means looking yourself up on the internet.
I did not know that. That explains why Liz Lemon was so cool the other day.
Liz Lemon. You mind if I Google myself in your office?
Sure, Tracy.
Can I use your computer?
How else are you going to do it?
Tracy, you're someone with a lot of problems.
It's so strange because it's so early in the series, and it's a very contemporary show. Like, the jokes often respond to what's going on, and like a dirty joke about Googling seems so dated now. But I like watching the reruns of it, so I'm glad that they've made enough of the show that it'll stick around for me to watch late at night. The other shows that I put on the list are not ending, and Homeland is actually in its second incredibly controversial season. I personally feel that Homeland, which is by the same guys who made 24, it had a brilliant first season that I personally feel should have been the whole show. And so when it came back for the second season, there's a way in which the first season could have ended in a very explosive way that would have been destructive for the ability to them to have the same cast for the second season. But, you know, a successful show needs to come back, and I really had my doubts about whether they could pull it off. But I have to say, so far this season has been fascinating. But last weekend, they ran an episode which was very over the top and seemed much more akin to 24 than a lot of previous episodes, and it created an explosive response on the internet. Some people loved it, some people hated it, some people thought the show had gone off the rails. And the thing is, as far as I'm concerned, the show is fascinating to talk about, and that in itself is a good thing. But I'm truly curious about whether they can pull off the end of the season, because in a tightly plotted show like this, basically if they go off the rails, people will lose faith in it. And mainly, the show survives on the absolutely brilliant performances of Claire Danes and Damian Lewis, who play the central characters. And one of the things I love about the show, and this connects it actually to the next show that I wanted to talk about, Enlightened, is that the main character, Carrie Matheson, is this extremely unstable, not entirely likable woman. She's manic depressive, she's obsessive, she acts very spontaneously in self-destructive ways. And to me, this has been a big breakthrough for television. Having main female characters who aren't likable, adorable, and wonderful and relatable, to me, expands radically the emotional range of what you can do on television as far as women's roles. Homeland has a character like that, and Enlightened does too, even though they're very different shows.
You're on season two of Homeland as well over there then, because we get Homeland over here in the UK, and it's been huge here as well. Damien Lewis obviously is a British actor and an American drama, and so it's one of those dramas that's really travelled across the Atlantic really well, I think.
I do think that what they've done on the show is interesting in many, many ways. One of them is that 24, to me, was a well-made and thrilling and incredibly toxic television show. It was essentially the propaganda arm of the Bush administration, and it had this complicated, cathartic relationship with all of the U.S. policies about torture and everything related to that. And Homeland, to me, is, if not an apology for the earlier show, it has this responsive quality because it deals with a lot of the same issues, but it has a very different take on them. And among other things, it really deals with the question of how to get intelligence from people who are considered dangerous or possible terrorists. And in Homeland, it's all about building intimate relationships. But one of the main themes of the show is that when you have suffered physically, when you've been tortured, when you've been in a war, it's not the kind of thing you bounce back from. Those are deep traumas and they don't go away. 24 was known for its completely horrible treatment of this, which is basically people would be tortured and then they'd pop right back up like a jack-in-the-box and go back to work the next day. Homeland is really about the bond between two people whose trauma is never going to disappear. And I think that's one of the things that makes it very powerful. And I'm curious to see whether they can pull up the second season.
And you mentioned earlier Enlightened. We've got a quick clip of that now. So let's have a listen to Enlightened, then you can tell us a little bit more about that.
Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I
People are living
job,
under the illusion that the American dream is working for them.
Still plugging away, huh?
No overtime, though.
I may not be at the top, but I'm happy.
No, you're not. You're miserable. They're firing all of us. Let's fucking turn the tables on them. I have something for you. This is a huge...
So that's a clip there of Enlightened, which is the new series with Laura Dern. Emily, you mentioned earlier that Laura's character, Amy, is almost dislikable, but she sounds like a bit of a hero there.
Well, Amy Jellicoe is a fascinating character. There's a level at which I think of Enlightened in this very odd way as the feminine mirror to something like Curb Your Enthusiasm, which also has this incredibly difficult to take, kind of uncomfortable to watch main character, but all the problems that Larry David has are, I'm not saying they're masculine qualities, but basically he's like irascible and neurotic and has trouble functioning socially. Amy Jellicoe's whole issue is that she had a nervous breakdown, went into this kind of new age recovery, and came back just wanting to love and feel and help. And it's this great show because it's both a satire of the new age sensibility and all the problems with that. And at the same time, I feel that the show is this extremely compassionate comedy in that it actually is genuinely about the fact that a human being, a very flawed and self-destructive human being, could really be striving to do good for the world. And it has this brilliant performance by Laura Dern. And as with Homeland, I think that having a main character who's as challenging as Amy is, where you half the time you feel very protective of her, half the time you just want to punch her because she can be so, you know, she thinks of herself as nice and good, but she's constantly doing things that are self-promoting or incredibly socially awkward, very uncomfortable. But she works for this large corporation that pretends to be kind of a green corporation. And a lot of it is actually this sort of brilliant satire of the circumstances of American corporations and the people who work within them. And this season, when she comes back, she actually aims to be a whistleblower. And it's this dark comedy of what it would mean to try to blow the whistle on a large corporation and yet have no ability to do so with any kind of ease. Anyway, it's a very moving show. I cry practically every episode. I mean, it's actually kind of wrenching, and I appreciate shows that give you a very strong reaction. That's actually true of the next show that I was going to talk about, which is American Horror Story.
So yeah, let's move on to that. Tell us a little bit about American Horror Story for people that may not have seen it who aren't in the U.S.
American Horror Story was created by Ryan Murphy, who's an extremely controversial television creator. He's the guy who created Glee. In the past, he also created Nip Tuck. And this is a guy who is devoted to making television shows that shock, offend, drive people crazy, give them really strong reactions. American Horror Story is a frightening adult mashup of horror films filmed in an extremely over-the-top, campy way. And the first season was set in a horror house that people bought that was filled with ghosts of murders. This season is in an insane asylum set in the early 60s. It involves nuns. It involves Nazis. It has this incredible performance by Jessica Lange. Lily Rabe is kind of stealing the show as a nun possessed by Satan. And it's the kind of thing where if you try to describe the show to people, they'll be like, what in hell are you talking about? And that's half of what I love about the show. But I think that despite the fact that it seems so campy and trashy and over the top, it's actually brilliantly constructed and beautifully filmed. And one of the episodes of it, which was called Anne Frank 2, so you can imagine the tone of an episode like that, was honestly one of the most hard-to-watch things that I've seen all year, but I thought it was genuinely challenging and brilliant. And I think Ryan Murphy often doesn't get credit because the stuff he's making is nothing that anybody would look at and think, that's a classy show. That's a beautiful, elegant show. They're not. They're actually filled with these wild, grandguignol swings. But I think what he's doing with this particular show may be a kind of masterpiece. He creates a lot of shows that are extremely variable. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're awful. But I actually think in this show, he's actually kind of hit on something that just sticks in your head and never goes away, which is its accomplishment of its own.
And that was Emily Nussbaum, TV critic for The New Yorker, talking to Monocle's Katie Bilboa there about American Horror Story and other TV shows that are being watched in the US and elsewhere. And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. So for now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch.
If you enjoyed the programme and can't wait another week, why not tune in to Culture with Robert Bound at 1900 hours London time. Here's Rob to tell us what's in store.
On the latest edition, we talk lost and stolen art as we investigate why paintings go missing, who steals them, where they end up, and we meet the super sleuth who spent a life undercover returning them to their rightful place.
We hand back to Georgina in a moment with a weekend edition next. You can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time. That's in 23 hours' time. Your hosts will be Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck.
You've been listening to The Review with me, Andrew Muller.
And me, Emma Nelson. Goodbye. Thanks for listening.